Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Hello, and welcome to the weekly podcast of The Critic. I'm Jo Bartosz, and today I am delighted to be joined by India's most provocative feminist filmmaker, Vaishnavi Sundar.
Hi, Jo. Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's good to speak to you. So first of all, I understand that that you were sort of beloved at the progressive left in parts of India because of work that you've done campaigning for emergency contraception and that sort of thing, and that today you're persona non grata. Could you perhaps give our listeners a brief overview of what's happened and your fall from grace?
Yes, fall from grace indeed it was. So I have been campaigning for women's rights since 2012-13 onwards, where I started using film as a medium of my advocacy. While making films, I was also parallelly conducting these campaigns and questioning patriarchy in general in media, the way they portray women in cinema and so on and so forth. But this one particular campaign about the sale of emergency contraceptive brought me to the spotlight of Indian media, where they really appreciated the effort that it took to talk to the drug control director to make him change the law, where there was no ban essentially for sale of over-the-counter contraceptives, but the pharmaceutical shops were just choosing not to do it on moral grounds. And having spoken with the drug control director, that informal ban was lifted. And the drug control director later on also made it as a precedent and asked the rest of the states to follow the same mandate. So it was pretty good. I should shamefully admit that the pharmaceutical shops have gone back to their old ways of not selling emergency contraceptive pills still. But I suppose we do need like a 2.0 of that campaign. Nevertheless, this campaign brought my work into the forefront, and it brought a lot of women's advocacy groups to sort of get in touch with me and do campaigns together and just work together for common causes that we both care about. It was all going fine, and I did a documentary on workplace sexual harassment of women in India, and the film was called But What Was She Wearing? It's a one-of-a-kind documentary because not only has a documentary on the subject never been made before, but it hasn't been made in a way that it takes into account the unorganized sector of the female workforce of a country. Considering India is a really large country and we have like a 70-30 rural-urban population, it makes no sense to talk about just urban, educated, air-conditioned, office-going female CEO, for example. But her concerns are just as valid. So this film talks about construction workers, sanitation workers, domestic workers, you know, daily wage laborers. All of those women's representative voices have been included in the film. And an Indian American nonprofit organization got in touch with me, asked to screen it in New York, and said that I should speak to a small group of people. I think about a week before the event was to happen, all other preparations were well underway. Poster and venue and all of those things finalized. They started marketing it even. And then they decided they don't want to do it because the moderator that they chose to question me during the event turned out to be one of those woke champions. And she apparently thought it was important and her responsibility to go through somebody's personal Twitter profile to see if I have said anything blasphemous. Of course, that's how people go about their lives these days, you know, find something incriminating online, completely unrelated to what is being discussed. Anyway, so she found out some tweets where I talked about males shouldn't be allowed in female sports, female-only spaces, etc., which I still stand by very proudly. And that somehow provoked the Polis Project, the organization. They decided that it was going against their policy of inclusion and diversity. So they decided to call the project off. The funny thing is, there is no other film made in this subject where you hear voices of construction laborers or a domestic worker or a sanitation worker where women in India who work in corporations, they have to actually clear human and animal feces from public spaces. I had representative voices about their experiences in the film. And these are all the women whose voices they claim to care about as well. But they decided because I spoke about transgender ideology, which has got nothing to do with the film at hand, They decided to cancel me again because of some tweets I made. And since then, it has just been like a downward spiral of word getting out and more people finding out about this, and just somehow without even truly critically looking at it, is she really transphobic? Did she really say anything that's unacceptable? Is she really a hateful person, et cetera, et cetera? They just decided to just, you know, blanket cancel me for everything. I used to write for Indian media companies 3 to 4 articles a month. They stopped commissioning. They stopped replying to emails asking me why they aren't commissioning. And then overall, there was just like a lack of response everywhere, even amongst friends and erstwhile colleagues and what have you. So I did indeed fall from grace for standing up for women's sex-based rights.
Thank you. And I mean, that seems particularly ironic, as I suppose in India, that there aren't even sort of many sort of protections for women or single sex spaces. And it seems sort of bitterly ironic that that a woman in America would deprive the world of hearing those voices. That seems quite shocking. So I understand that that you have now gone on to explore transgenderism and the threat of transgenderism within India. Why did you pick up on that as an issue of concern?
Yes, definitely. What happened to me after the proverbial cancellation was that I started getting a lot of these online abuse and vitriol that sounded very similar to what happens to women online that I have seen before, mostly women in the UK and the US, and the kind of swear words that were being used. And the pattern was just very, very similar. And that got me interested into finding out why are Indian people who have completely different way of life, completely different issues, just mirroring this social media phenomenon as if it is their own. You know, they're talking as if it is their issue, their civil rights issue, and they need to care about it. They need to speak out against it. Otherwise, you know, they'll lose their social capital or something like that. And that was interesting. And I started digging deeper and found out that the gender identity ideology had very well infiltrated into the urban elite section of the society. And given that India has the biggest population right now, we beat China very recently by 1.4 billion strong. And considering we have rape cases of about 86 a day, this is just reported cases. And there are all kinds of other forms of violence reported and unreported. And there are murders, femicides. There are villages where young, because sex determination has been made illegal because people were just going and having female feticide done. So they made it illegal. But now after a child is born, once they find out that it is female, there are remote corners of villages where there are these old women who have a certain lullaby that they sing to put a child permanently to sleep if she's female. This is India now in some rural corners of the country. This being the case, it made so much sense to me that, of course, young girls wouldn't want to be girls. I didn't want, I mean, 3-odd decades ago, I hated being a girl. I hated it during puberty. I hated that my breasts were growing. I hated that boys were looking at me differently. I had short hair, but I never really had an opportunity to transition back in the day. Thank goodness for that. But it is definitely a thought that kept lingering on my mind. Why is my brother getting all of these privileges and I don't? So it made sense that that exploration was long due. So I made a film called Dysphoric, which started out as a single documentary, but ended up becoming 4 parts. And in that, I started exploring gender identity phenomenon overall and how it particularly affects and has a pernicious effect of women and girls in India, where they have more reasons to flee womanhood. And since then, as well, the wall of silence and the whole tag of being a cancelled filmmaker has never changed. When I write to media persons asking them if they would like to even write a bad review for Dysphoric, I wouldn't hear back from them. And they would all unfriend me from social media, very, very petty things like that. And I've since just assumed that one day I was there talking in panels and meetings and people were calling me for quotes on social issues about a certain film and things like that. Another day, I've just fallen off the face of the earth. It was like that. But that didn't deter me. I have carried on speaking about the issue and thankfully have found some sort of a sisterhood and camaraderie amongst women outside of the country and some women inside the country who are with me politically on this issue.
That's good to know. And I understand that your latest film is looking at the experiences of trans widows. Could you perhaps explain a bit about what that is and why you decided to focus on that issue?
Yes. When I finished making Dysphoric, it made sense to me to also focus on how else are women affected by this ideology? Where in Dysphoric, I explored the phenomenon as if young girls were opting to, quote unquote, become males. I was wondering how it would affect females if their male partners, adult partners, were to transition. What would go on in the minds of children, say, whose father suddenly says, "You'll have to call me a mother from today, and I'm going to wear your mother's clothes," and things like that. What effect would it have on society at large and individual families specifically? So that exploration led me to read a lot of stories about trans widows, as they like to call themselves. These are women who consider themselves widows in a way that their partners have somehow stopped existing as they know them. And I don't care to question whether it's the right word or not, because when you have all kinds of really bizarre terminologies like golf widows, I thought it was perfectly okay for these women to call. And that group of people are the ones that consider their old name as their dead name. So it makes perfect sense that trans widows call themselves trans widows. So I started reading about all of that, and initially there was a lot of fear and anxiety around, will I have enough voices to talk about this issue? Will people come forward? Will they be shy, etc.? And also, I had to parallelly keep in mind about how transgenderism in itself has a very profound effect on Indian society as well, because transgenderism in itself is like some sort of a nucleus that brings together all other forms of sexual slavery. For example, you have a very strong connection between transgenderism and prostitution in India, because a lot of these trans-identified males are seen soliciting in open roads, and that's not considered illegal. Brothel owning is illegal, but sex work, quote unquote, is not. So you'd see a lot of these men who consider this to be their livelihood, because their system is such that they have to make that money and have to pay their mother or their guru or somebody. That's how that hierarchy works within their community, the Hijra community. So a lot of them are seen running prostitution. And if you talk about any form of abolition, any form of exit, it immediately trips them off. And you have international bodies coming in, falling over each other and saying, "No, you can't talk about that like that. Sex work is work. You'd ruin the livelihoods of all the trans sex workers," and so on and so forth. And not to mention how pornography and transgenderism is also very acutely connected together. You have grown adult males who may or may not have been married, but look, middle age, upwards of, I don't know, 40, 50, whatever, are in the subreddits called Indian Sissies, where they talk about wanting to be sodomized, wanting to be all kinds of really horrible terms that I don't wish to say here. But these are men who could have a wife, who could have a child, and he could be living that double life. And it is possible, because in India, there is a cultural phenomenon called kotis, where you can live that double life, where men are accepted to have this wife and family or whatever, and then they can carry on living this other life where they wear women's clothes, have a woman face, so to speak, and do prostitution and other things like that. And not to mention how transgenderism promotes this very concept of misogynistic, hypersexualized idea of what a female is. And that then permeates into the society that you can never get rid of those stereotypes or never get rid of gender overall. So all of those things really deeply bothered me. And trans widows issues and all of these things put together seemed like a very, very pertinent topic that I thought I could explore as my next film. And that's when it all came about. Thankfully for me, a lot of trans widows were very forthcoming. Many of them are from so many different diverse backgrounds, from different countries, different ages. Some with children, some without children, some married, some. And all of them came with their own sets of problems and challenges that were very unique to them. And at the same time, when you look at it from a big picture point of view, very similar as well. So it's still ongoing. I'm in the process of still seeking more information, trying to put all of these pieces together.
Thank you. So what are the commonalities in the experiences of the diverse women from around the world that you've interviewed?
Yes, it's so fascinating because for some women for whom this experience happened when they were, say, early 20s, and now they are in their 70s, talk about how they were manipulated into staying in the marriage despite being completely not okay with the sexual perversions that they were having, that they were subjected to in their bedrooms. And the same exact thing is said by somebody who is in her early 20s or early 30s now. So that has been so strikingly similar. And it was almost as if those men were very confident that these women were never going to leave them, because that's how they groom them. That's how they make them be dependent on them, that leaving them would become very, very difficult for the woman. And, you know, living with a wife and a child in a society that generally accepts that sort of a model gives him a sort of a position in the society, right? So he would rather not let go of that wife, even if she hates being subjected to all kinds of sexual perversion by him, probably being raped by him, probably children are neglected by him. They're forced to stay married. That's one commonality that I have seen. And when it comes down to the perversion with regards to pornography, has also been consistent. The kind of pornography now that we watch is so easily accessible in terms of internet pornography. You can just stream basically anything, and it's a matter of two clicks and you can be subjected to one of the most grotesque, hardcore pornography that you have ever seen in your life. And at the same time, back in the day when those things were not accessible, there were these magazines and pamphlets and everything where pornography was very much a part of their identity, if you will. Mm-hmm. Their inspiration for being what a female was were derived very directly or indirectly from pornography. And that was another commonality. And with child custody constantly being used as a means to blackmail, if you will,
yeah,
where mothers are very afraid and worried, very rightfully so. And they don't want to let the children be subjected to any of these, exhibitionism, if you will, that fathers are sort of living their life as in. They're wearing women's clothes, they're wearing fake breasts and other things. They don't want their young children to be subjected to all of that. They know him as their father, and it would be such a weird thing to grow up. And I have now got my worry in place where these children will grow up and they will probably have all kinds of psychological distresses growing up in a house where, you know, parents are fighting and you don't know who your mother is, who don't know who your father is, etc., etc. That has been another commonality as well. But at the same time, there have also been cases where there was absolutely no symptom whatsoever. There were no indications. The women did not see it coming. But one fine day, they uncovered this entire underground of clothes and wigs and silicone and all of those things, and it was as if they were even married to the same person.
So have you managed to find any women in India to talk about this, or has it all been women from elsewhere?
Unfortunately, because of the language and because of the lack of vocabulary of calling themselves, say, trans widows, or to even know that such a term exists, I think it is going to take us a bit more time. But having said that, there are women who are divorcing men who have sought surgery, and courts are permitting it. And they're not permitting it because they care for the women, of course not, but they're permitting it because it is no longer a family unit, you see. The man has had a sex change, so it's not a family anymore. Therefore, the woman can definitely seek divorce. That has been happening. And it's very hard to chase after these women because it's just really, really rare. And the challenges of these women being public about it or even being anonymous about it is going to be very difficult for them, because it is very easy for these men to find them out and abuse them further. And for all you know, these women are probably still living with the husband for the sake of children and other reasons, financial reasons and things. And I imagine this happens a lot in that Koti community that I mentioned, where probably women know that they don't have a choice but to stay married to a man like this, and this is his life. He will probably have a different sexual experience outside, and she has to continue putting up with his proclivities in the house without ever being able to question that ever. So I don't have somebody from India, although I am regretfully very confident that that's not going to be the case in a few years' time. And the number of people in Bangladesh, Nepal, Pakistan, and other South Asian countries, women are going to speak up about, may not have the same vocabulary as the whole world understands it just yet, but there will be women whose husbands are seeking this, that are porn-induced, and they don't want to live with a man like that anymore. This is on top of the existing cases where violence against women in marriages is on a skyrocketing level in India. And if you're raped in a marriage, it is not considered illegal. So if you go to a court and say, my husband's raping me every night, the court judge would just say, well, you're married to him. That is no grounds for divorce. This is where we are. And you know, to have this new phenomenon introduced, my head is just spinning, just thinking about what implications this ideology is going to have on Indian society.
And may I ask, I mean, do you see it? I know there are existing cultural phenomenon that this has mapped onto, but do you see it as something essentially colonialist brought in by NGOs, by American-led organizations, that sort of packaged as civil rights? Or do you think it's valid to say that there is something, that it's just sort of a new way of looking at an older cultural phenomenon?
I suppose there's truth to both the things that you have mentioned, Joe, because the cultural phenomenon have predated, you know, the current way of looking at gender identity ideology. The men who are perpetrating it probably don't even know the terminology. They don't even care for the terminology. They don't think about pronouns because many of them don't speak English. So for them, all of this is just absolute rubbish. We have hundreds of languages, thousands of dialects. Everything is sex-based, and it's impossible for somebody to stand in front of you and you having to guess what their preferred pronouns were that morning and how that might change in the afternoon or some bullshit like that. That's not possible in India at all. And not to mention, many of these men who had this cultural cultural phenomenon, that who have subscribed to this cultural phenomenon, don't really want to be part of this modern day, postmodern movement. They want to be left alone. They have their thing. They want to live their life in a way that they are, you know, cross-dressing or whatever. They just want to be left alone for the most part. What has happened is the infiltration of all of these organizations, you know, foreign organizations, government and government-aided organizations, UNAIDS and all of those, Stonewall, John Hopkins and all of them entering into India.
They have Stonewall in India.
Definitely, yes. They are building an empire. I can say that very confidently because they have tied up with a lot of these really powerful, rich corporations and are conducting the age-old workplace equality index or something like that, where you have every single organization that has signed up to it has gender-neutral toilets. And these are organizations that haven't even sorted out their internal complaints committee when a woman goes and complains about sexual harassment that she faces at workplace, but they now have a gender neutral toilet as if that is going to solve the issue rather than make it worse, right? So all of these intrusion of all of these industries where they see India as a huge market, it makes sense just by sheer number, right? Just on an experimental basis, if they were to sort of just come inside and test the waters, and they have a huge market. Indians would literally lap up anything that comes from abroad, anything. So when they have an organization coming in with funding, they're never going to say no. That's why all these women's organizations that used to work with me before don't want to speak anything about the transgender ideology, because perhaps they are getting some sort of a tiny little funding from, say, Melinda and Gates or, you know, John Hopkins or Fernway Institute or somebody like that, or Mama Cash, for example. Who knows where they're getting their money from? They're not going to disclose that. So it's safer for everybody to just maintain that status quo without really questioning the sudden increase in the way the age-old phenomenon of hijra or whatever transgenderism that it was back in the day, and how they are able, how they will have nothing, no reason to justify in the present day that you can give a child puberty blockers because she's saying that she's a boy, or, you know, she's saying she's non-binary or something. There is absolutely no connection to it. It's outlandish to link these two. And when you try and make that statement to them that this is wrong, and these are two completely different phenomena, you get ostracized for being, I don't know, in my case, they consider that because of my caste privilege, that I don't understand the plight of the marginalized community, or that I am some sort of a conservative woman because I am from a certain caste, therefore I only think of myself and others in my caste, etc. So that's one thing mm-hmm. that gets thrown about a lot. But funnily, we are the world's largest democracy, Joe. We have 1.4 billion people, okay, and there isn't even 15% female political participation in this country. And we have all kinds of affirmative actions that are in place but are never, ever implemented in full. The 33% quota has never happened. And we already now have trans-identified males competing in women-only reserved wards and winning elections.
Oh, my God.
Where we haven't even, you know, sorted out the affirmative actions that are meant for the female sex class. We already have these men doing it. And the men, trans-identified men, are asking for all kinds of reservations in many different industries. They want the same facilities as a widow who might get a job on a compassionate basis, because apparently they are both marginalized communities.
Right.
And they want access to female-only prison estates because they are apparently females and they might be subjected to violence in a men's estate. And I wonder why that is. So all of these things are happening in India as we speak, but there are very few voices that, you know, challenge it or as much as even know about it.
And I understand that in some states, in some areas of India, sex reassignment surgery, or so-called sex reassignment surgery, is now state-funded. Is that correct?
In every state, you walk into a government-funded hospital, you can get sex reassignment surgery for free. And there are also union government-commissioned insurance for about 5 lakh rupees. That's a lot of money that you can apply if you have a transgender card or something like that. That's another complaint that they have. Apparently, self-identification is what they want. They don't want to have a transgender ID. They want to have the opposite sex ID. So they have all sorts of complaints. But yeah, you can walk into any government hospital and you can get sex reassignment surgery. You can get insurance money for it. And you also have insurance provided by corporations that, especially funnily, under Stonewall Equity Index, who give you money on a premium basis for facial feminization, vaginoplasty, double mastectomy, hysterectomy, everything, including paid leave for recovery and recuperation after surgery, all by insurance companies in corporate organizations in India as we speak.
That's obscene. And I mean, it's kind of mind-boggling to think that's the same country where women have elective hysterectomies in order to make themselves more productive agricultural workers, so that they don't, you know, so they're not pregnant and menstruating.
You're absolutely right. Tea estate, women working in tea estate have had such terrible fate, having to forcefully go to get their forced hysterectomy done because they are expected to work long hours, and menstrual cycle sort of put a break in their productivity. So they are having to go get forceful hysterectomy. And meanwhile, all of these trans-identified females are getting the same thing because they think if they become men, they can officially like women, because lesbians don't have role models. And they believe if they love women, they ought to be a man. Therefore, it just becomes a thing where justifying the end. You give them all of these things, and ultimately that's the destination that on a tunnel vision you're sending them towards. And it's just working perfectly like a conveyor belt right now.
It sounds like essentially in India, women are burning and transgenderism has poured petrol on it. Would that be?
Gallons and gallons of petrol, yes.
Yeah. And if people want to find out more about your upcoming film or support you, how can they get in touch? And what are your plans?
For the film that I'm making on trans widows, is called the Behind the Looking Glass. It's a film that is it's a very ambitious project, and it's an excellent production because a lot of these anonymous characters, I'm bringing them to life from zero, and creating these characters from scratch with the help of animation. So it's a very ambitious production in that it is financially very charged. So I'm seeking donations from everybody who thinks that this subject needs needs a wider audience, and those that want to donate and support my work in general or specifically for this project can always visit my website, limesodafilms.com/donate. And all the information that needs to that one needs to know is there, and they can read and they can contact me on social media. I'm Vaishax everywhere. They just have to search Indian turf, probably, then I might just show up.
Woman most cancelled in India. Brilliant. Thank you so much for your time. It's been really interesting talking to you, and all the very best with the film.
Thank you so much. Thank you.